Talk given Sunday, August 20th, 1978. The whole of the animal world, including us human mortals, consists of creatures who are creatures of feeling, essentially. As far as we humans are concerned, there are additional features, namely thought, which of course includes, therefore, speech, and desires. Desires are the real driving force in us, both conscious desires and unconscious desires, hidden desires. We must try to understand why and how our desires come to be what they actually are. It is a noticeable feature throughout the human race that the desires of people, whilst falling under certain general types, are nevertheless also distinctive of each single person. Each person has his own desires, and associated with his desires, his particular ways of expressing them or trying to fulfill them. This is the greatest driving force within us. But its root, its fundamental root, is our feelings. This is bound to be the case because the body itself is derived from a primordial ancestor who was an animal altogether. And all animals are the creatures of feelings. Stimuli from the external world, the environment, and the events which take place in the environment raise up feelings within the animal. And these feelings become mainly certain drives, the drives of the animal, essentially or almost exclusively for self-preservation and the preservation of the species. And those two characterize every single living creature in the animal world and the human world. Also, there are certain drives which come through because of the evolutionary process. Aggressiveness, for example, a sense of self-protection. Animals are very sensitive to danger, much more than we are, because we, through our evolution and our socio-cultural development and so forth, have become somewhat free of so many ordinary dangers in our everyday life. Now, feelings are either pleasant or unpleasant. Occasionally, somewhat rarely, they are neutral. They are just sensations which are pure sensations and therefore practically confined to the physical level, to the body. We have examined this matter in the past too, but it would be useful to recapitulate some of the essential points. The body, the human body, like the animal body, like any other animal body, has an ingrained pleasure-pain mechanism, which is indispensable for its survival. If there were no such mechanism, the stimuli of the external world could easily destroy the animal, because the animal wouldn't know how to avoid a stimulus which was too dangerous or too harmful. Now, we derive that from our animal ancestry, this pleasure-pain mechanism. But the interesting part of the story is that the physical body takes the pleasure-pain mechanism in its stride as a matter of course. It knows that if a stimulus goes beyond a certain limit of pain, then the body is in danger. It definitely knows that. See? And where pleasurable sensations are concerned, there too there is a limit. If the in the ordinary way, the pleasurable sensation is one which assures the body that there is no danger, it will not be wiped out of existence. But there is a psychical correspondent, counterpart, a psychical counterpart in human beings, which perhaps is only very rudimentarily developed in the rest of the animal world. And this psychical counterpart consists or is expressed by the statement, "I like this sensation. It is pleasant. I like it." And with the liking arises the desire to have more of it, to get attached to what is pleasurable. And contrarily, if something is unpleasant, the psychical counterpart is embodied in the statement, "I don't like this, I dislike it." And as we know, our likes and dislikes are as varied as there are human beings in the world. And in association with the unpleasant sensation and the dislike that is raised up, sometimes to the limit of hatred, and plus fear, anxiety, and so forth, makes the person feel that he wants to be rid of it in the first instance, or he would like to destroy the source of the painful sensation altogether. And therefore, aversion grows up within us human beings. Now these two, the attachment associated with the pleasurable and the aversion associated with the unpleasant, become fixed ideas. Our thinking process has come into being. Our cognition, our power to cognize this, that or the other and form concepts about it has come into play, and these become fixations, mental fixations, and they dominate us all through our life. So what was just a normal pleasure-pain mechanism of the body, which worked automatically in order that the body may be preserved and safe, has now in addition this psychical counterpart. And either consciously or unconsciously, we all know that whilst danger to the body could mean death, we realize that pain to the psyche, although it may go to the limit of pain, so to say, to the extremity of painfulness, of misery, of grief, and so forth, the psyche will not be killed by it. The psyche is a convenient word to express the mental processes which are manifest in every living human body. We don't really understand the psyche. There are certain elementary things we can know about it, that the psyche is something which functions as a single organ, if we may use the word organ, but that it has no separate organs like the body has, a liver, a kidney, a heart, a brain, and so on. It hasn't any separate organs. The psyche as a whole experiences the particular psychical condition, whatever it may be. You see? So we know that this psyche does not die with pain, unless and until it so affects the body so very strongly, because physical cells and psychical processes are really one whole process, one whole organic process as such. Cells will die, and if the psychical effect is extremely powerful, it will affect the cells and produce illness. You all know about neuroses and psychoses and all the rest of it. And if the thing becomes too powerful, it can push us into action which is destructive to our cells. So, we have to bear in mind that the psyche is something we have to attend to. Pay attention in such a manner that we really come to know what the psyche is, how it functions. And this is not easy. Our desires are all psychical expressions. It is not exclusively the psyche which expresses desires. The psyche and body are inextricably associated. So it's a psychophysical expression. Desire is a psychophysical drive with psychophysical expression and psychophysical consequences. Now, considering the nature of our development, our human development, since our primordial ancestor changed into a man, into a human being, has been determined principally by two great forces. One is natural evolution, and that natural evolution is responsible for what we call our heredity. And the other is our cultural, socio-cultural conditioning. We perhaps lean too much towards our socio-cultural conditioning. This is what is handed down to us by our parents, by our friends, by the customs of our community, its ways of life, and the knowledge we have acquired, the cultural knowledge we have acquired in all departments of our life. So those are the two very powerful drives, influences. Now, the bulk of us human beings are woefully ignorant of the trends of the life force within us human beings, which are moving the whole human race towards its fruition within the limited context of humanity as such. There is definitely a purpose in our existence. Purpose does not exist at all where totality is concerned. Totality can have no purpose. It's only a limited context which can display purpose, because purpose implies relationship. This, in relation to that, can have a purposeful interaction. The totality is the totality. What is it? What else is it related to? There is no else where the whole of the universe is concerned. That is the whole of the universe. But within this whole, which has manifested itself in terms of an infinite variety of particular types of manifestation, each type of manifestation has a purpose in its existence, for its existence. It is the totality which comes to fruition through each type. The items, the individuals, so to say, composing each type, may imagine that they come to fruition. But it is totality which comes to fruition through them. By and large, we may say, in the plant kingdom, totality comes to fruition in terms of the flower and the fruit. And in a perfectly healthy tree, as such, it comes to fruition there. In a tiger, totality comes to fruition as the perfect tiger. An ant, the perfect ant, or a butterfly, the perfect butterfly. Or in a man, the perfect man. Now, as far as this planet is concerned, and as far as my little knowledge goes, all that is on this earth comes to fruition spontaneously, naturally. It is not conscious of the nature of fruition. It cannot think about it. It cannot form ideas about it. I think if you had the capacity to communicate intimately with a rose or a gardenia or a daisy or a blade of grass or anything, and could inquire what is the purpose of your existence, it simply can't answer at all. It would never understand such a question. It just happens. It will just say, oh, I'm just a rose, I'm just a flower, I'm just a blade of grass. There's nothing more than that. But with us human beings, this thought process, this conceptualizing capacity, this mental card index which we have, enables us to formulate concepts about our fruitive process and the nature of our fruition. Now, there are very, very few, there have been and still are extremely few, who can suggest really something of the true nature of our fruition as human beings. There are only very few. Those very few somehow emerged into that state where, in trying to understand themselves, they understood the nature, the fundamental nature of the drive of desire within themselves, and discovered whether that drive within themselves was in tune, in harmony with the trend of life itself in the human kingdom. Now, this has been presented through the centuries in certain ways in the great scriptures, and it's only the great scriptures which I believe have suggested, presented something of the actual truth about this. What does it mean to be a man? If you take the Old Testament, the early books, you get this remarkable myth of the Garden of Eden and the tree and so forth. This tree of life, as it is called, which is planted in the middle of the garden. And the Bible also says the tree of good and evil is also in the middle of the garden. I wonder how many people ever take the trouble to solve this riddle. How can you have two trees whose terms of description seem to indicate that they are quite different trees, tree of life and tree of good and evil? And these trees are both in the middle of this garden of Eden. Eden, which means delight. The meaning of the word. The zest of life. Life itself, in its utterly blissful creative activity. It is the meaning of Eden, really. You may be reminded of the Vedantic, the Brahmanical, Upanishadic, Sat, Chit, Ananda, to describe Brahman, the absolute all. You see? And there is the story with respect to Eden goes on to say that you may eat. Adam, the word Adam means two or three, it has two or three principal meanings. But one meaning is that he who was made out of the ground. Now don't think of the ground as the earth, or the field of grass or something like that, the ground, or the ground on which this house is built. But ground in the sense of the original source. The German Grund, I think, has that significance more than in the English word ground. You see? The original source. Adam was raised out of the original source. And the supreme aspect in Adam, represented by Elohim or Yahweh, or both if you like, laid a command, you may eat of the fruit of this whole garden, excepting the fruit, as it is put in the Bible, of the tree of good and evil. But actually, the teaching must have been, I take full responsibility for this aberration from the scriptural statement. Actually, the commandment probably was, do not pluck the fruit of the tree of life until you are fit to do so. And the fruit of the tree of life for man represents the trend of life for man's development and fulfillment. That fruit is consciousness. That is the fruit of the tree of life. Human consciousness. Now, do not get muddled here. Our capacity to think, our capacity to use our sense organs and to cognize and recognize all the impressions that come to us, the stimuli that come to us from outside, or which emerge from within, or which are the results of an internal process of thought or feeling or memory, you see, all this is not consciousness. Consciousness is not a state of mind, as we call it. Consciousness is the unknown mystery. It is the supreme thing. It is the supreme no thing, which comes to full flower in us through human organisms. When it comes to full flower, it is of a nature which is utterly indescribable. It is not knowable. In other words, because it is indescribable, words and concepts cannot be used to convey it. It is the unknown, it is the unknowable by the brain, or in terms of concepts and words. That is consciousness itself. Now you see, this we can associate with the primordial creative energy which functions throughout the entire universe. And it functions in terms of the infinite, the immeasurable, the immortal, in terms of eternity, not in terms of space, time, matter, possession. You see, it is very important to realize this. And when man comes to his supreme fruition, the perfected Holy One, then that consciousness is functioning through him. He can't analyze it. He cannot perceive it, because perception is externalizing. I, the subject, am perceiving that the object. It can never be an object of thought, an object of feeling. No sense perception, no sense faculty can grasp it. It is. And sense consciousness within itself is that kind of absolute. You see, you may just as well equate it with the primordial energy which creates the entire universe. Now that is the wonderful thing which is man's destiny. You see, but it grows out of this organism which starts as an animal beginning to wake up, a human animal beginning to wake up with all the potentiality of this divine fulfillment in it. Very few ever do wake up, ever do recognize this divine potentiality. See? All right. So when Adam plucks the fruit, and that plucking the fruit was no disobedience at all. It was God Himself, Yahweh Elohim Himself, who made Adam do that. Well, all these things, of course, are quite contrary to and will be hotly denied and disputed by all good theologians and scholars and so forth. But let's forget that. Our task is to try and understand in a new way, a different way, something of the real deeps within us. So this fruit of consciousness which he plucked was plucked in a moment of inspiration. Who inspires him? The woman, Esha. Now the name Esha stands for the daughter of Esh. Esh is the creative fire, the creative energy, in other words. And Esha is the actively functional aspect of this creative power. That's what that woman is. And the Lord God, having caused that sleep to fall on Adam, took his rib, as they say, and produced Esha. And when he came to consciousness again, there was Esha present. Not as a living human being. That woman, Esha, is different from Heva, the actual woman who is the idealized picture in the inner depths of consciousness of Adam, mankind, the idealized picture of his hidden counterpart. So that in the male body, Eve is really a female. In the female body, Eve is really a male. It's all within the mind. Potential energy. Now, Adam was not fit for this. Now, that is precisely the condition in which we ourselves are. There is that in us, Esha, this functional thing, active functional aspect of the creative fire, which somehow stirs us under certain circumstances. Maybe we hear somebody speak, maybe we read scriptures, maybe the marvel of nature or some unconscious process which goes on inside us and which shoots into consciousness somehow, if only for a fraction of a second, and has inspired us, and we sort of begin to awaken to this. And suddenly we discover, yes, this is marvelous. But within a few minutes, or certainly within a few days, that inspiration has gone. And we are back in the ordinary realm of turmoil and struggle and misery, the slaves of our animal-derived desires and feelings. Now you see, it's really important to sense this. Don't try to think it, because if you try to make a thought structure, you'll fixate your own imperfect ideas, because we are quite imperfect yet. Our brains are just totally inadequate in their ability to deal with this. It is something immensely more than the brain which functions. But if once we really sense it, there lights up a sense of transcendence within us. Now that light never goes out. Once that sense of transcendence lights up, then it will affect you throughout your life. It may be suppressed. It may be suppressed for years, but it will always remain a light inside, moving you to grow towards this fulfillment. And in the process of the growing towards fulfillment, you will start questioning your desires. You will start being fully mindful of all your feelings, all your reactions. Our feelings are impure feelings. Impure not merely in the moralistic sense, because we have magnificent feelings, noble feelings, and all the rest of it, you see. But not in the moralistic sense, but they are impure in the sense of being imperfect, distorted, inadequate. You see? So, as we remain awake. Now this is where we change the course of things by intensely aspiring to the realization of this spark as something which will become the perfect light within. That is also, if you like, a form of desire. But it is desire and yet not a desire. Desire in the ordinary human sense is self-oriented all the time. It is self-centered, egoistic, vain, selfish. You see? Whereas this aspiration is something which is the power which makes us break through our shell of ignorance, of greed, hate, fear, delusion, stupidity, incapacity, double dealing with ourselves and with the rest of the world, and so forth. You see? So this is pure aspiration. The Buddha's second statement with respect to the Noble Eightfold Path. Perfect understanding, perfect aspiration. This flame of aspiration. You see, it's the purifying fire. Now, this is Esh itself, or the fire of the Zarathustrians. they are called fire worshippers, but this is what the fire represents, you see. This aspiration, that comes into being. And in Buddhistic terms, kama chanda, chanda is desire, you see, gets transformed into dharma chanda. They use the same word, chanda, desire, but have a different qualifying adjective to it, you see. Kama means sensuous, confined to the sensual, you see. Again, sensual, not merely in the moralistic sense. That is all included, of course, but much more than that, the whole of the sense functionings, which means the whole story of our feelings throughout life. See, because whatever the senses convey are taken up by the nerves and the brain of the body, and they are sensations, and it is those sensations which are the feelings. Most of what we believe is marvelous intellectual, mental activity within us, our intelligence at work, the Buddha described as the writhings, writhings, of the mind. These are the writhings of the mind. The mind cannot writhe, the pure mind cannot writhe at all. It just is pure intelligence which has perfect insight. Samadhi, or in the Sanskrit form, samyag drishti, perfect sight. Drishti is sight, insight. You see? So perfect understanding comes in consequence of the kama chanda being transformed into the dharma chanda, the law, the truth. Not law in the sense of that which is laid down by agreement between the people composing a society, something imposed. But this law is this inherent power within our own being, the trend of life in each of us towards fruition in human terms. Just as that same trend of life has a different form for the plant, for the animal, the whatever it is. So you see, it becomes extremely important for us to understand our feelings to start with. And our feelings have two main aspects to them. One is the reception of stimuli, and the other is the reaction of stimuli to those stimuli. Our reactions are deeply associated with our desire drives. So in understanding our feelings, we also begin to understand our desires. And self-knowledge grows thereby. And when this sense of transcendence through all sorts of conditions in life, and most people do get some opportunity to experience it, suddenly get this spark alight, then those feelings become transformed into the perfect feeling, the true feeling. And that true feeling perhaps finds its supreme expression in the word love, if you like, in the word compassion, the Mahakaruna of the Mahayana, also in perfect wisdom, because the two invariably go together. And thereby there is man's fruition.